says, you've got one?
No, I've got
that's very strange.
Thank you.
Talat Bloomfield, which one is that?
That's short stories. Right, so we're going to explore some aspects of the Megillah. Of course, here we have, as I brought last year, this old Megillah that belonged to my grandfather. Probably from Warsaw. In the
Kitab, yes. They probably brought it over because with the Latin in there and everything.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Very beautiful.
Wow, I've never seen that. In Latin.
Oh, right. Yes.
So, when I was so the Hebrew thing
my grandfather
is this too. The chapter is a letter.
So how old do you think this is?
Well, here's chapter
two. Although the truth is, it's just as old when I read it. So it could be 1888.
And that's Book of Esther.
Yeah, the Book of Esther. Yes, handwritten on the page. Yeah, and
I have Haggadah from the publishing house.
Yeah, and this one does not have HaMelech at the top of every column. And there's another.
Hello, Leo. How lovely to see you.
Hello, how are you?
It's very nice to see you.
Yes, of course. Leo comes to town. You'll be more comfortable here.
Yeah, take a seat then.
We're doing Megillat Esther tonight.
What time of year again?
Yes, it is indeed. And do you know anything? Do you remember anything about Purim?
Well, I remember some of it from last year. Yes.
Historically, it's 2000 and what?
About 500, 400 years ago.
It was during the Babylonian
exile. During the Babylonian exile.
This was about 500 before.
I know, but I just wondered if we could pinpoint it exactly.
Word of every column.
Oh, right.
Because
so this is called the HaMelech Megillah.
Okay.
Yes. See, you, Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, in this Megillah, the word HaMelech is at the beginning of every column, except the first one. Yes. So.
Why?
Carefully. Now, can anyone suggest why?
Well, HaMelech, referring to God.
Right. Oh. Yes. What? Who is not mentioned in the Megillah?
God. The name of God.
God.
Anywhere.
That's right. He doesn't have the name of God. So by putting HaMelech at the top of each column.
Right, okay, so it refers to.
It's although normally in the simple reading of the text, that's talking about the king, King Ahasuerus.
Yes.
But nonetheless, by putting HaMelech there, that is a hint to God.
Yeah.
So that's the. So in other words, the whole thing is a story where God is there all the time and yet never mentioned. The hiddenness of God. Yes, whereas this old Megillah, which is older than that one, does not have that. See, this is not a HaMelech Megillah. This
so, any reasons why some do, some don't?
Oh, it's just different just customs.
So where does the HaMelech custom come from?
That's an interesting question. How far back it goes, I don't know. It's not mentioned in the Talmud, as far as I know. That doesn't mean that it wasn't happening then. One would have to look at ancient Megillahs, the oldest ones to be got. I'm not quite sure how old the oldest Megillah is.
There are some that are beautifully decorated.
Yes, well, they would usually be of a later period. They would be of the Middle Ages.
Middle Ages, yes. They are so rare to come by.
Oh, yeah, very beautiful.
Very beautiful.
Yes, yeah, but one would need to try and find one from the 5th century, 6th century. Mm. You know, that would be a fine.
Yeah.
Maybe, who knows.
Can I just ask one point of information, because I forgot to look it up. We have to read it twice, or we have to read it in the morning?
No, we have to read it twice. We read it here. In fact, here is a leaflet which will provide information about that.
Thank you.
So here we are, Millie.
Thank you, and I'll give you one. Thank you. Oh, what a jolly one.
Actually, the divine name is mentioned if you take the bracha that you say beforehand.
Ah! Thank you. All right. Yes, that's a very good point. So let's just have a look what it says over here. It's a discussion in the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a suggestion in the Talmud that it's sort of analyzing the text of a statement by one of the earlier sages. And it's, you know, so one suggestion is, well, does it mean that you read the Megillah once, and once you learn the Mishnayot about the Megillah? Because there's a tractate of the Mishnah called Megillah. And then they say, no, it means you read the Megillah twice. And that is the practice. So Saturday night we read the Megillah, and sometime on Sunday.
Yeah.
So it could be in the morning, could be in the afternoon, as long as it's before sunset. So sometime on.
And what happened in Shushan Purim, in Jerusalem and other walled cities? They used to read it three times?
No, I think they do everything, all the mitzvot of Purim, on the next day.
On the next day?
Oh, no, which? Yes, I think they do.
We in Jerusalem used to celebrate it 2 days.
Well, the celebration continues two days anyway.
Isn't this thing with the walled city?
Walled systems.
Yes, yes, that's Shushan Purim.
Yes, yes. But in fact, it's all the mitzvah, I think, both the reading of the Megillah and also giving a gift of 2 items of food to another person and giving charity to 2 different people. So finally having a seuda, having a meal. So on Sunday the idea is to have a meal together, and that is the Purim seuda, the Purim meal. So the way many people organize it is that they have some kind of party on Saturday night, Sunday morning, and where they hear the Megillah. Then Sunday morning they hear the Megillah again in the synagogue. And also, Saturday night, people will hear the Megillah straight after the conclusion of Shabbat.
Sure, yeah.
So the people will in the synagogue. Then will be going to the synagogue Sunday morning, hearing the Megillah. Many people do. And then Sunday afternoon, having a seuda, having a meal. And sometime during Sunday, also managing to give mishloach manot, to give a gift of 2 items of food, of which there's a great industry of packing rather more than 2 items, and in beautiful, presentation baskets and all kinds of finery. And of course, there's the custom for people to dress up, especially children, and a lot of giving of charity, collecting of charity takes place.
Let's go back to the absence of the name of God and the fact that it is the only book in the Tanakh. There must be a reason why God's name is omitted. By implication, you say, of course, he's there, and then as a kind of aide memoir, some copies of the Megillah actually insert Melech.
Mm.
Just in case you forget, but is there some deeper reason why God's name doesn't appear?
There's a simple reason and a deeper reason.
Can we hear both?
I can probably cope with the simple one.
Well, the simple reason is that the Purim Megillah was conceived as a letter. It was a letter to be sent around the Jewish people, telling them the story of Purim and announcing that this is a festival to be observed. And by reading the Megillah, that is how one, part of the way in which one is observing the festival. So a letter is something which is quite likely not to be treated with the kind of sanctity that a Torah scroll, for example, or tefillin, would be treated, because it's something that's going to be passed from hand to hand, and so therefore it doesn't have the name of God, so as to reduce the risk of any profaning of divine sanctity. That's the sort of simple halachic way of looking at it. But the more profound way, in fact, leads to the depths of the story of Purim. And if we could just start by thinking about Esther, who of course is the hero of the story. Now, Esther had two names. Does anyone remember the other name?
Esther Malka?
No.
No, it was Esther Hamalka. She was Esther the Queen, but she had another name as well.
I don't remember.
She never told me.
it is mentioned here.
It is in the Megillah.
I can't remember.
Let's see if we can find it in the Megillah. So,
story of Esther. Good, absolutely.
It's when we get to the, it's chapter 2.
Ishi Hudi Hayabushoshan?
Yes, that's right. So when you look at verse 7, chapter 2, verse 7.
Vayi omenet Hadassah.
Hadassah.
Yes, Hadassah, Esther bat Dodo.
Right, so there's Esther and Hadassah, like the same person. And Hadassah, of course, it means myrtles. And in the Bible, Hadassah is something very spiritual. In the book of Zechariah, it speaks about an angel standing among the Hadassim, standing among the myrtles, a figure standing among the myrtle. And so there's something very spiritual about this concept, Hadassah. And there's a fragrance. Of course, the hadassim, the myrtles, are used for the lulav and etrog as well. And so there's this extra dimension with the hadassim and the hadassah, who is Esther. Now, why does she have two names? What's the significance of the two names? Is it just, and what does Esther mean?
Yeah.
What's the meaning of Esther? Any suggestion? Ba'anochi astir haster hanai.
Oh, veiling.
Yes, veiling, hiding.
That's right.
Esther, like you say, nistar.
Yes.
Someone is hidden. Sadiq nistar, hidden.
Yes,
sadiq. Yes. So Esther represents hiddenness.
Hester Panim, very good.
Now, Hester Panim is in fact the concealment of the face of the divine.
Yes.
But
it's also used as having withdrawn from intervention in history.
That's the way in which we understand, or some people understand, certain phenomena in history, terrible phenomena, that this is where God has hidden himself. That's the hiding of the face. The hiding of the face.
There's a famous author, Denister, yes. Mm.
Yes, there's a writer, Yiddish writer. Yes. Yeah, very interesting figure. So there is this hiddenness.
Russia, that's right.
So the idea of the hiddenness of God is in fact what the story of Purim is about, because it's a hiddenness of God on several different levels. And one is the very fact that there is this terrible threat against the entire Jewish people, that there's someone who wants to wipe them out. And the extra horrific dimension to that is that Ahasuerus is seen by the sages as the head of a, as it says in the Megillah, he's the head of a huge empire. And wherever the Jews were, they were in that empire. So if there was a decree to exterminate the Jews,
everywhere.
That was everywhere.
This is a Persian empire.
Yeah. Yes, it was the Persian Empire, which at that point ruled the land of Israel.
All around. Syria, all around. The whole, most of the Middle East.
So to escape from that, they would have to escape from the known world. It's, it would be going in completely... So that's one aspect of the hiding of God. Another aspect of the hiding of God is within the Jewish people themselves. The story begins, let's go back to the beginning. Vayehi bimei Achashverosh hu Achashverosh hamoylech mahoidoi ve'ad kush. So there we have King Achashverosh ruling from India to Ethiopia, right? It tells us there how far the extent of his empire was. 127 countries. And he made a great feast. Look at that, verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of the provinces, everyone. Everyone was invited, and it was a huge crowd, where he showed the riches and glory of his kingdom. Now, and this was a very long festival.
Lasted 180 days.
Yeah, amazing.
Well, they had nothing else to do.
They knew how to celebrate.
Yes, they knew how to celebrate. Yeah, well.
But presumably they had the resources to celebrate for 180 days, so they must have been quite prosperous.
Yes, yes. Yeah,
well, I mean, this empire from India to
everyone is giving taxes.
Yeah.
Yes, and in fact, the last chapter, if you look at chapter 10, right at the end, it says, and King Achashverosh imposed a tribute upon the land. Vayasem HaMelech Achashverosh mas al ha'aretz. So he's certainly into getting taxes
and
organizing banquets and having them paid for.
Yes.
So there was no national debt after that. However, you can assume that they did get a bit bored, and that was why he wanted Vashti to come without, as it says, that's verse 11.
To show off as well, wasn't it?
That's right, Lahavi, yes, he commanded, verse 11, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the royal crown to show the people and princes her beauty. The sages point out that when it says with the royal crown, it means not wearing anything else, just wearing a crown, and so then everyone would see.
Oh no!
Well, it's Persian.
You have to wear a crown if you're queen, yes.
Well, that would. But she didn't want to come, and she refused to come. So. In 20th century feminism, you know, like this is seen as a wonderful thing. She's exerting her right, you know, not to be profaned in this way. However, the sages say it wasn't on account of modesty or even independent thought. It was simply that a terrible rash had broken out over her body, which she didn't want anyone to see. So it was actually vanity, which preventative.
How do they derive such a hypothesis from the verse as it stands?
Well, you know, sometimes what the sages say needs, if you like, or takes advantage of some little blip which is in the text. But there is another narrative just going along at the same time, and in fact there's a targum. There are two targumim of the Chumash. One is Targum Onkelos, which was written by Onkelos the proselyte to Judaism. That's the tradition about it. And it's very straight, very straightforward. And we also hear in the Talmud that it was guided by various rabbis. Rabbi Akiva was one and some others. And it was a very straightforward translation, much praised by later commentators like Avraham Ibn Ezra, speaks favorably about this Targum, this translation. Rashi very often quotes it. But there's another Targum called Targum Yonatan. Yeah. And the tradition is that's by Yonatan ben Uziel. And that is full of stories and extra illuminations of the text. And so this is a and then there's the Midrash Rabbah, where there's a whole section.
Just tell them when were they written?
Well, the Midrashim, they start at the time or before the a little bit before the time. You see, there's a collection of Midrash from Rabbi Yishmael.
Now, what I'm trying to say is that if it was written about that time or shortly afterwards, maybe it was hearsay, or
I'm sure
that somebody who's at the party said, "Oh, she heard that she didn't want to come."
Well, we don't say that the Midrash was written at that time, but there is the idea of transmitting of traditions of different kinds. The Midrash was finally written down. I mean, most things began to be written down around the year naught. Just around the time of the destruction of the temple. The Mishnah was written around the year 200. But there were some Midrashic compilations before them. And some after them as well. But there is a sense not only of tradition, but a sort of illuminated view of the text and of the events, and a kind of a channeling, a spiritual channeling of thought, so that there is a way in which the Midrash is another form of spiritual illumination. You've got the actual text of scripture, and then there are other dimensions as well in Jewish thought which also have a spiritual illumination. And so the Midrash, the Mishnah, the Talmud, in fact there is a passage in the Talmud which describes Moses on Mount Sinai during the 40 days and nights, and he was able to see all the future generations of Torah teachers. And so everything that would ever be taught about the Torah was revealed to Moses on Sinai. So there was this totality of Torah was revealed to him. And then he came down the mountain, and his face shone like the sun, and he began to teach Joshua, and Joshua's face shone like the moon. So there was this transmission, and there's Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai, passed it to Joshua, and he then passed it down, and it went down through the ages, and eventually was written down in the Mishnah and so on. Now, it's very interesting because the Megillah, in fact, was written in the middle of that whole period. Moses was around something like 800 years before the Megillah was written and before the events described in the Megillah took place. But nonetheless, there's the idea that Moses on Mount Sinai was able to see all of time and all Torah teachings and everything that would happen to the Jewish people as well. So that's why it said, when he went up the mountain and he's looking at the land of Israel, Ad Hayam Ha'acharon, to the furthest sea. He could see to the furthest sea. So the sages say it's not only the furthest sea, it's Ad Hayom Ha'acharon, to the furthest day. So that sense of all time being encapsulated and being able to see. So there we have the constant comments of the sages, which help, if you like, transform what could be just an interesting story into a very profound teaching, which is at the very heart of the consciousness of the Jewish people. And the whole way in which we relate to ourselves, to the divine, and experience the world around us is all due to these many layers of interpretation. So that's the... so there we have the people, the Jewish people in this banquet. Now, one of the things that it mentions here, it says that there are beautiful vessels, beautiful golden vessels there. And the sages tell us that among the vessels, the beautiful golden vessels, were, who can tell me, which vessels?
From the temple?
Yes, exactly right. There were vessels which had been taken in the temple. There were a lot of golden utensils, and now the temple had been destroyed and all its artifacts, many of its artifacts, had been taken away. And they had now come to be in the possession of the Persian Empire. It was destroyed by the Babylonians, but now it's the Persian Empire which is ruling. And so these vessels were put on display. Now, how should the Jews have reacted if there is a banquet where the vessels from the temple are on display? As the sages see it, they shouldn't have got this. This was a terrible profanation of their own temple, and there the spoils from their temple were put on display. But they didn't take any notice. They went, yes, they enjoyed themselves, they had a nice time, they ate and drank. So their sense of Jewish identity was so low that they didn't even notice, they didn't remark on this fact that the temple vessels were there. Then it says, one of the things it says about the food at the temple, at the party, just a second. Yeah, that's in verse 8, and the drinking was according to the law, none to compel, no one was forced. So the king enjoined on all the officers of his house to do according to the pleasure of every man, right? Verse 8 in chapter 1. In other words, kosher food was available. It was quite possible to say, excuse me, I only eat this and I can't eat that, and because it was this lavish banquet and it was they wanted to provide everyone with what they wanted. Incidentally, in the book of Daniel is where you have the first occurrence clearly of vegetarianism. Apart from the very beginning of the Bible, because the beginning of the Bible, the sages tell us, Adam and Eve and the next few generations till Noah only ate vegetable food. They didn't kill animals for food. It was only after Noah's ark that they, and the flood, that they began eating animal food. But in the book of Daniel, which is more or less the same time as the book of Esther, there is the case of three young Jewish boys who have been taken into the palace. by the king, who wants to have, he's heard the Jews are very clever.
Belshazzar was the king?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Is it Nebuchadnezzar?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Of course it would be. So
yes.
Belshazzar's feast.
No, no, I know, because we have this beautiful painting that Rembrandt had done of Belshazzar's feast. And I always assumed that it was from the book of Daniel.
It is. Yeah.
It is. So who was Balthazar? It was also a king.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's in like the next generation.
I see.
Yes. One of the things that happened to Nebuchadnezzar is he was changed into an animal and ran around in the forest for 7 years. And Blake has a beautiful painting of that.
Yes.
That's,
yes.
So these three children were taken, and the idea is they're going to bring them up in the palace, and since they're very clever, they will help the government. There'll be a little think tank over there. So these boys are they're teenagers, young teenagers. So the immediate problem is they do not want to eat the meat that is being provided, and they don't want to have the wine that is being provided. And they've got a steward who is looking after them. And they say, don't give us the meat or the wine, just give us vegetable food. And he said, how can I just give you vegetable food? You won't be healthy. And then it'll be off with my head. So they said, try us for 2 weeks and see what we look like after 2 weeks. So for 2 weeks they ate vegetable food, and in fact they looked healthier than everyone else. So whether that was miraculous or simply that vegetarian food is to be recommended, that's
to Yanni.
So there we have, in this banquet they could have had kosher food according to the Midrash. And based on this verse here, that everyone was given whatever they wanted, but they didn't. Most people didn't choose to have kosher food. They didn't want to be different. They wanted just to be exactly the same and to eat the same food as everyone else. So in that sense, it's a time of concealment of the divine. You know, then comes this terrible attack from Haman, who sees that although the Jews, see, here we have, on the one hand, the Midrash is saying that they were not very observant. It wasn't a very observant the Jewish society. But even when Jews are not observant, they're very distinctive. And Haman, he saw this very distinctive nation. Let's just see how he puts it. This is when Mordechai won't bow down to Haman. Let's just look at that. That's in chapter 3.
So they were from Shevet Yehuda or Binyamin? I thought
that's an excellent question.
Because I thought most Iranian, Persian, were from Shevet Binyamin.
Well, Mordechai.
He's not. He says.
It says he's. What does it say?
Asher huglata im Yechoniah melech Yehuda. So he's from Judah.
Yes, but you see, in the kingdom of Judah,
yes,
were the tribes of Yehuda and Binyamin.
Also, I didn't know.
And Levi, yes.
I had no idea.
When Binyamin went to the sailors and they go.
No, that's
Zvulun and Dan.
Yes, yeah, they live near Haifa. Port.
So Binyamin, Gama, they were also in Judah.
In the kingdom of Judah. There's the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Judah is the southern kingdom, and there is Yehuda and Benjamin. However, it's a very good question, because when it speaks about Mordechai, it says in this verse, chapter 2, verse 5, Ish Yehudi Hayah, there was a man who was a Yehudi. Now the question is, what does Yehudi mean? Nowadays the word Yehudi means a Jew. But what does it mean in this context?
From Judah.
And he was in Shushan, the capital, and his name was Mordechai, the son of Yair, ben Shimi, ben Kish, Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin.
Oh gosh, it's very confusing. So it's Yehudi, could have been Yehuda, and then he's from the Shevet of Binyamin.
Yeah, so he's from the tribe of Benjamin. So the Talmud discusses this sort of discrepancy. In fact, what Milly said, you could say he's from the country of Yehuda, but he's from the tribe of Benjamin. You know, that would be a possible way of solving the problem. But the Talmud finds a different way to solve it. Because in fact, this is the first book in the Bible, in chronological terms, in fact, I think it's the only book, where the Jews are called Yehudi. The word Jew is what became the word Jew. Ish Yehudi. And that's, and so the Talmud says, why is Mordechai called a Yehudi if he's actually from the tribe of Benjamin? Because Yehudi would suggest he's from the tribe of Judah. And it answers, Kol mi shekofer ba'avodah zarah, anyone who denies idolatry, nikra Yehudi, is called a Jew, is called Yehudi. So Yehudi is an expression of denial of idolatry.
But how did they come to it? Because of the tribe's name? How did it come about?
Sorry? Or the kingdom.
I mean, the kingdom of Judah?
Well, the kingdom of Judah certainly denied idolatry because it was the northern kingdom which served idols.
Yes, yes.
But whether it's exactly that, you see, the word Yehuda it relates to the word Hoda'ah, which is acceptance of the divine. One who accepts the divine is called Yehudi. And so, and that means rejecting idolatry.
Beautiful. Mm.
And so that is why. So when we look at section of chapter 3, which is on page 184, here we have the king making great Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the Agagite. Now the Agagite, what tribe is Agag from? Going into the ancestry of Haman. Anyone remember Agag figuring in biblical texts?
From Noah.
From Noah? Mm. Well, we're all from Noah.
No,
it wasn't one of Noah's sons. Noah had Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Agag is there in the book of Samuel. Agag is the king of Amalek.
Amalek. Of course, yes.
That's right.
That's right.
He is the king of Amalek.
Amalek, yes, which are the worst.
Well, that's right. The Amalekites appear in the Bible as a really vicious lot. And Haman is descended from the king of Amalek. So this giving of his pedigree, Haman the Agagite, the Amalek. The Agagi. And the problem that is happening over here is in chapter 3, Acha hadvarim ha'ele gidal ha'melech ha'chashveosh et Haman ben Hamadata ha'agagi v'yenaseu. The king made him great. V'yasem et kiso me'al kol ha'sarim ha'she'eto. The king gave him a throne higher than that of all the other princes. V'chol avdi ha'melech ha'sheh v'sha ha'melech, all the servants of the king in the king's gate, korim u'mishtachavim la'hama. They were bowing down, prostrating themselves to Haman. Ki chein tziva lo ha'melech, because this is what the king had commanded him. U'modachai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. And Mordechai would not bow down and he wouldn't prostrate himself. Now the Talmud comments on this. You know, if you were going to get the OBE or something, you know, so you might well bow down to the queen. I'm not quite sure what the exact protocol is, But bowing down is a fairly normal activity and doesn't carry any negative connotations in normal life. However, according to the Talmud in Tractate Megillah, there are two ways of looking at it. One is that Haman thought of himself as an idol. The king has made him very exalted and given him a throne higher than everyone else. And the king says everyone should bow down to him. From the point of view of the king, this is the bowing down that any senior statesman people should bow down to. But from the point of view of Haman the megalomaniac, that is because he is the god, Haman. Yes, like Claudius the god, Robert Graves' book. So there is Haman thinking of himself as a god, or another possible suggestion given by the Talmud, he wore an idol on his chest, his favorite idol. So anyone who bowed down to him was automatically bowing down to that idol. And because of that, Mordechai did not want to do that, and he wouldn't bow down. And this was what got Haman very angry. Haman was aware of this. Verse 5. Vayar Haman ki ein Mordechai koreo mishtachavelo. Haman saw that Mordechai wouldn't bow down and prostrate himself. Vayimale Haman chema. And Haman was filled with anger. It was a small thing, it was ridiculous in his eyes, just or a loathsome thing, just to attack Mordechai. Ki higidu lo et am Mordechai. They told him, who is the people of Mordechai, the Jew? Vayevakesh Haman lahashmid et kol hayuhudim. So Haman wanted to destroy all the Jews. Asher b'chol malchut Achashverosh, am Mordechai. All the Jews throughout the kingdom of Achashverosh, the whole people of Mordechai. So that was what Haman, but then he goes to Achashverosh. First of all, he throws lots to see what is the best time to attack the Jews. That's what happens in the next verse. And it came out in the month of Adar, which is where we are now. Tonight is the 12th of Adar. And then in verse 8, over the page 185, Vayomer Haman lemelech Achashverosh. Then Haman said to King Achashverosh, Yeshno am echad. There is one nation, mufuzar umuforad bein ha'amin, scattered, fragmented among the peoples, b'chol medinot ha'melech, malchutecha, among all the and the countries of your empire. V'dateyim shonot mikolam. Their religion is different to that of all any other people. V'datey ha-melech einam osim, and they don't keep the religion of the king. V'la-melech ein shoveh la-hanicham, and it's not worth it to the king to keep them. And then he says, as it's often pointed out, there's always an economic dimension to everything that happens. Im al ha-melech tov, if it is good in the king for the king, yikatev la'abdam, let him write to destroy them. Va'aseret alafim kikar kesef, and 10,000 talents of silver, eshkol I will give al yedei osei ha-melecha, lahavi el ginzei ha-melech, to give to the king's treasure houses. So I'm going to give you this bribe of 10,000 talents of silver, quite a large amount, in order for you to just sign this piece of paper and say, get rid of them. So that's the... So that is the concealment of the divine. There we have the divine concealed in a political sense. Why is God letting this happen? It's the hiddenness of God. And in terms of the Jewish people themselves, their own sense of Jewish identity is also hidden. That there is the Esther dimension, that complete hiddenness, being absolutely hidden. Now, of course, coming to Esther, now she herself is a hidden person. Because the king, having dispatched Vashti, it's interesting, it wasn't his idea to get rid of her. He was very angry that she didn't do what he wanted. But then you have a scene where you have the king's advisors. This is on page 181. Well, maybe it is him initiating it. It's verse 13. Vayomer HaMelech, this is after the whole thing where Vashti refused to come. Vayomer HaMelech leChachamim, and the king said to his wise sages, and there's a whole list of them. And verse 15, Kadot ma la'asot b'malka Vashti. What to do with the queen Vashti? Because she didn't do what the king said she should do. So now what should he do? He's taking counsel. So Mumuchan says to the king, Lo al ha-melech levado avta Vashti. Vashti didn't only do bad to the king himself. It's to everyone. Here we have a real piece of male chauvinism. It's everyone in all the king, all the countries of the king's empire. Look at verse 17. Ki yetzed va'amalkal kol anashim. When the word of what the queen did will go to all the different women, lahavzot ba'alein be'enehem. The women will despise their men. They won't do the washing up. But Omron, they will say, HaMelech HaChashverosh Amar Lahavi Et Vashti HaMalka Lefana Velo Ba'ah. King HaChashverosh told Vashti to come before him and she didn't come. I'm not going to do the washing up. I'm going to sit and write a book on the computer. You do the washing up. So there we have, as a result of this, they advise that he should find a new queen. And that's when you have all the different girls in the whole kingdom coming to the king. We're going into chapter 2. It describes how this will be. Vayavked HaMelech Pekidim. The king appointed officers, b'chol medinot malchuto, in his entire empire. Vayikbetzu et kol na'ara b'tula tovat mareh. They gathered every single virgin who was beautiful, el Shushan Abira, to the capital city Shushan, el Beit HaNashim, to this gigantic harem, el Yad Heges Chis HaMelech Shomer HaNashim, to the eunuch called Heger, who was the one in charge of the women, v'naton tamrukehen, he was the person in charge of giving them all kinds of perfumes, v'hanara shetitav be'enei ha-melech, and the girl who will be good in the eyes of the king, timloch tachat Vashti, she will rule instead of Vashti. And the king thought this was very good, and he instructed this should be carried out. So this is all being suggested. This is being suggested to the king what should happen, and this is what actually did take place. That's where we meet Mordechai and Esther. And Esther is taken to be one of these girls, and she doesn't reveal who she is. She doesn't reveal that she's Jewish. And so that is, again, the hiddenness which is taking place.
Over how, what is the period of time that this whole story actually takes place? Because there is a decree that then does not happen, and then we have the whole...
Yeah, that's all within a year, from the decree, yes.
Right.
But before the decree, the decree is after Esther is chosen to be queen. So we have, first of all, the banquet with the problem with Vashti, and then the suggestion to gather all the girls, and they're all gathered, and then there is Queen Esther is chosen, and then we have Mordechai not bowing down to Haman, and Haman becoming angry, wanting to destroy all the Jews. Now, from that point, it's all within a year. But the timing might be a bit longer between the banquet and the appointment of Esther as queen.
Okay.
Here it also says that Mordechai instructed her not to tell.
Yes, yes.
Sorry, Mordechai?
Told her not to tell.
Told her not to tell who she was, yes.
Is there something hidden about Mordechai as well? I mean, this whole story of this uncle and that niece, whom he's protecting, who is like a Don Quixote, I mean, basically refusing to bow to second to the king.
Well, one of the ways of that the Talmud presents Mordechai, Mordechai is a member of the Sanhedrin and is a leading figure among the Jewish people.
In Madai, in
yes,
yeah,
and he was also a controversial figure, and we see the way that he's a controversial figure from the very end of the story. If you look at the very last page, this is one of the verses that we say aloud. You know, when the Megillah is being read, there are four verses that we say aloud. Two of them are about Mordechai when he's first introduced, and then La Yehudim Haita Ola V'Simcha, and this last verse. Ki Mordechai HaYehudi Mishnei LaMelech HaChashverosh. Mordechai, the Jew, was the second in rank after King HaChashverosh, great among the Jews, Gadol LaYehudim.
To the multitude.
Yeah, now it says, acceptable to the multitude of his brethren. Now that's a careful translation, because if we look at the Hebrew,
Ratzui,
he was acceptable. Lorov, Echav.
Not to everyone.
To most,
yes.
To most of his brethren.
Yes.
Seeking Doresh Tov La'amor, Doresh Shalom L'chol Zaro. Seeking good for his people and speaking peace to all his seed. So what does it mean, most? Why not all of them? So the Talmud says, because he was so involved in affairs of state, because now he is the uncle of Esther, and he is therefore involved now in more governmental things. Now it's come out that Esther is a Jewish woman, and Haman has been killed, and all the enemies of the Jews have been killed. So the other sages looked askance at him, because he wasn't simply steeped in Torah study the way they were, sitting in the Sanhedrin. He's seen as one of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, one of the men of the Great Assembly, at the beginning of the Second Temple period. So, and in that form, he wasn't quite like the others. He was too involved with public affairs. So there's the controversial dimension about Mordechai. It's, you know, it's a little bit like Maimonides was a controversial figure. He too much philosophy, this, that. It's all kinds of arguments in the generations after Maimonides. There were tremendous, even in his lifetime, there were some tremendous arguments about him. So there is a way in which there's a kind of an enclave image of Jewish leadership, and then there are Jewish leaders who are broader and
embracing other.
Has there ever been sort of a parallel with Joseph?
Well, that's very interesting.
Because of the second to the king and stuff like
yes,
that.
And
yes.
Not only that, also reaching out to and world affairs and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, being involved in world affairs. Yeah. Yes, yes, that's a very interesting concept.
We don't know if he had children. There is nothing about him except for that. Did he have descendants? And
right, Mordechai's children. No, that's a very good question. I don't know the answer.
Mordechai's children.
Mm.
Nice title for a book or a film.
Yes, Mordechai's children. Yes.
Television series.
Kissinger.
That's right. Yeah, now one of the theories about Esther's children is that one of her children was the Persian king who agreed that the Jews should go back to Israel and rebuild the Second Temple, Darius. So there is Dariavish. So
Dariavish again.
Yes, so there is the idea that he was actually a son of Esther. So So that's. But Mordechai's children, I don't know anything about. That is that would be a good book. So there is Mordechai, who is a deeply spiritual person and a leader, but Esther represents someone who at this point in the story is also completely hidden. She is hidden in the palace. She is the Jewish woman who is in a completely foreign environment. And there are various midrashic stories about this. How did she manage to keep track of Shabbat? Shabbat is every seventh day, but the ancient Persians, according to this story, didn't have a seven-day week, as indeed the Romans didn't have a seven-day week later. So she would have seven maids, one servant girls. One girl would serve her each day, and one of them was represented the Shabbat, so she knew when that one was there, it was her turn, she knew that day was Shabbat. So in that way she was able to keep track of Shabbat during. This was, I've heard from people, not so much Shabbat, because people who were put in prison in Stalinist Russia, Hasidim, who were fighting to preserve Judaism and were arrested and put in prison. So they knew when it was Shabbat because they did know when the days of the week were. But it was extremely hard to keep track of the festivals. And this was the great challenge for someone who might be spending years and years and years in a labor camp or something like that, to be able to keep track of when the festivals were. And there was one person I knew, Rabbi Mendel Furufas, who was in prison in Russia, and he said that the building was like a building around a central staircase, like and so all the cells are like around the walls, but there's a central well, a stair well, and someone shouted up in Yiddish. It was Rosh Hashanah time. Heint is Rosh Hashanah. Today is Rosh Hashanah. He just called up. And Reb Mendel, who heard this, was pleased that by his own calculation, also today is Rosh Hashanah. You know, keeping track. Keeping track. That's, so these are, you know, hidden, being in hidden situations. And the hiddenness. So there's the political situation, the threat against the Jews, the assimilation of the Jews is another variety of hiddenness, Esther herself being hidden. So that's the dimension of concealment. Then we have another dimension, Hadassah, that Esther is also known as Hadassah, and Hadassah represents something spiritual, tangibly spiritual, something revealed as spiritual. And that is what gradually emerges within the story and the unfolding of the events, that the spirituality of the transformation of the situation from one of threat and destruction to one of salvation, where the Jews, the enemies of the Jews, who were unfortunately manifold at this point, it's quite intriguing. Why were there so many enemies of the Jews? And it just seems to be a case of people hating someone different. There you have people who are different and they hated them. I probably told you the story about my budgerigar.
About?
My budgerigar.
No.
No? Okay, well, this is an event that had a great effect on me. It was when I was 10 or 11 years old. And at that time, I had a great passion for rearing budgerigars. And I had many, 15, something, 14, 15 budgerigars, which hatched. You know, we started with two, and then they had more, and so on. So we had a whole cage full of budgerigars. And I became, someone taught me how you sit all night with your hand in the cage and the Bhajigar in the dark, and then the Bhajigar gets used to you and stands on your hand. And so it got to the point that I was able to take my hand out of the cage with the Bhajigar on it, and it would sit on my shoulder, and I could walk around in the garden or the street. I took it to school once, and
so it would fly away.
Most of the time they didn't fly away. Sometimes they did, and then what we would do would put the cage in the window, and it would come back to the cage and hang on to the cage, and we would open the cage and it would pop inside. You know, it would prefer being with its family and friend. However, one day this Bhajigar flew away, and I thought, well, it'll come back in the normal way, you know, after an hour or two. Now, we lived in a, sort of a London block of houses in Finsbury Park, where you had all the gardens were like, you know, quite a large area of green in the middle, and then there's like a rectangle of houses all the way around. And there was a huge tree in the middle of this grass area, which was all the gardens. And suddenly I saw what seemed like...
Hello, Alan. Nice to see you.
Hi, how are you? What seemed like hundreds or thousands of birds wheeling around this large tree.
Right.
And that was very striking, what, you know, these birds. And then as I looked, I was somehow able to see that in the middle of all this was my little coloured Bhajigar. And these sparrows, which look very similar to a Bhajigar, except that they're brown and the Bhajigar is a bright colour, blue, green, they were wheeling around it because it was different, because it was a Bhajigar. And they killed it. The Bhajigar never came back. And that later on, I'm not sure if it clicked. It made a great impression on me then. I was crying. I was very upset having lost my Bhajigar. But I think that it was sometime later on, it suddenly occurred to me, that's the nature of the Jew, with this sort of bright, you know, cosmopolitan dimension. And it disturbs people. It can disturb people. It's, there are different reactions, different responses. But that's why, you know, we're looking at the Purim story, how it is that the Jews had so many enemies around the Persian Empire. They're not described as doing anything which angered anyone. You see, in Egypt, there was also, when the Jews were in Egypt, they were multiplying. So then the king of Egypt was worried the Jews will be a fifth column. If anyone attacks our country, there are these strangers in the country and they'll join with the attacker. But there's no hint of anything like that here in the Purim story. It's just that there's a vast empire and the Jews in many different places. And wherever they are, there are some enemies. You have also the reverse relationship with the Jews. Rabin me'ami ha'aretz mityahadin is one of the things that happens near the end of the story when Haman and his 10 sons have all been put to death by the king, and everyone is suddenly very conscious of the Jews in a positive way, or many people are. So there were people in favor of the Jews, and there were still people against the Jews. And so
those that converted, that's what you're saying.
There were well, mityahadim might be converted to Judaism, and might also mean just favored the Jews. They became the fans of the Jews. It could mean both. But there still remained enemies. And the thing is that the decree that Haman organized with the king paying him 10,000 talents of silver was that all the Jews could be killed by their enemies. They couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't raise arms to defend themselves. What's Mordechai and Esther managed to achieve what was that the Jews were permitted to defend themselves. And so that was what happened. That was what happened on the 13th of Adar. They defended themselves against the enemies, and thank God they were successful. So throughout the empire, they were successful. And as a result of that, on the next day, which is the 14th of Adar, this year, Sunday, the coming Sunday, they were they relaxed and they had the peace and the enjoyment of the Purim festival. And then that was written in the Megillah as a letter by Esther, and so we call it Megillat Esther. And then this was sent round so that the next year, the following year, that should also be a festival. It should be something every year. And the Talmud gives an account of a conversation between Esther and the sages, where she says, "Kitvuni l'dorot, write me down for the generations that the Megillah should be read. It should be a festival." So the sages say, if we publicize this whole event, it's going to cause enmity between the Jews and the non-Jews. The non-Jews are going to see that there was this event where people wanted to kill the Jews, and then instead the tables were turned. So Esther says, you know what? It's in non-Jewish history anyway. It was because it says in the Megillah that it was written down in the chronicles of Persia and Magi. So it's already been written down. So they know about it. So the sages said, all right, in that case, we'll institute it as a festival. So there is that. So there is the festival. However, what we're exploring is the idea of hiddenness. You see, Esther has two names, Esther Hadassah. And the word Esther, the word actually means hidden. In Hebrew, Nisar means a hidden person or something hidden. So Esther is the one who is hidden. So, and her other name is Hadassah. So there's the matter of trying to understand this relationship between Hadassah. Now, Hadassah implies revelation. Hadassah implies the revelation of spirituality and holiness. Now, this process is described in a discourse which I was reading today, and I thought I would try to share with you. And what we're really talking about is the Sfira Malchut. Malchut means kingship. So this is the sort of Kabbalistic dimension. Let's see if I can draw this diagram. And the thing is that there are the way that the discourse describes it is that there is the realm of the infinite, of Ein Sof. You can see my... Sorry.
Could you see?
Okay. Yeah. There is the infinite, Ein Sof. That is the absolute boundless dimensions of godliness. And without taking any notice of this at the moment, we have all the stages going down, and the lowest level of the world of Atzilut is Malchut, is kingship. So this is the world of Atzilut, the world of emanation. Now, kingship, on the one hand, it's the lowest level of this world of Atzilut, where it's revealed as something holy. But on the other hand, it goes down into lower worlds, which are the lower world, lower than Atzilut, the world of emanation, comes the world of creation, of formation, of action, lower and lower down to this physical world. And kingship is there, but in a completely hidden way. In fact, the Kabbalists use the phrase, it's not mentioned in this discourse, but it's mentioned elsewhere, Ragleya yordot mavet. Her feet go down to death. The idea of this spiritual life force which goes down into a realm of concealment and of evil and of everything problematic. And so there is this sort of lower level of kingship. Now that is the concealment, the hiding. That's the quality of Esther. Now, if you take it to a higher level, there is a higher level of kingship, which is really what's called Malchut de Ein Sof. Now that's a fascinating way of describing a certain level of the spiritual universe. That in the infinite there is the quality of kingship, which is the essence of all the kinds of kingship which are going to come about. In other words, everything is there, all of existence. And all the different varieties of existence are already there at the most exalted level. And that is something which is generally completely hidden. So we've got the kingship, the spirituality, which is there in the world, which is hidden because it's in a coarse world, and it's hidden there. And we have its source, its very intense spiritual source, which is also invisible, which isn't operating. Now that's so if you consider the God and the universe. But it's also so in the individual. The individual also has different dimensions within himself or herself. And so there's the aspect where there is a spiritual quality, but it is somehow, it's in exile, it's captured, it's dealing with all kinds of other problematic aspects of life, and it's been caught in those negative things, in the and so that's this Esther dimension, the hidden dimension. And there's also in the deep recesses of a person's being, there is this very spiritual quality representing Hadassah. And so what the process of life is to try to reveal the Hadassah within ourselves, that it should be revealed in the kingship and all the different levels of kingship, that we should be able to reach to the very essence of our being and reveal that holiness which is there and allow that to come into play in the way in which we live in ordinary daily life. Now the question is, how do we achieve that, and how do we actually see it in the story of Purim? Now here we come to two ways of understanding what kind of threat the Jews were under in the Purim story. And I'd like to introduce you to a term used by historians, which is modern antisemitism. Modern antisemitism differs from medieval antisemitism. Can anyone tell me in which way?
Political racist rather than religious.
Yes. Yeah, and so what's the effect?
In medieval times you could convert to Christianity and mm-hmm. you wouldn't be persecuted anymore. Who was the, in the film Shoah, there was this historian who did so very nicely. That there was a progress throughout history from the medieval times with the Inquisition, for example. You couldn't be a Jew here, to you couldn't be a Jew, to finally in the Second World War, the Shoah, you couldn't be. So this was sort of the progression from religious anti-Semitism, against the Jews, as the killers of Christ, through to Jews because they exist.
Right, that's it. Yes, that's exactly it. Now the question is, was the Purim story a case of modern antisemitism or medieval antisemitism? Now see, medieval antisemitism, it's baptism or death, and if the Jews were baptized, then much of the time they would be all right. Not always.
Not always. Not there always. Time that no, if yeah, the neighbour yeah. didn't like you and went and learned
it. Well, in Spain, in fact, yes. Spain itself was an example of modern anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Because the Jews who converted to Christianity and became what is called Moranos,
new Christians.
Yes, yeah. The conversos. They often suffered terribly from the Inquisition, from an unhappy servant in the house who would make accusations which were not necessarily true. There were people who were trying to live as good Christians who were hauled before the Inquisition and tortured and burnt at the stake. There were others who were deliberately trying to live as Jews and were concealing this. When you look at Yitzhak Ber wrote a two volumes on the Jews of Christian Spain, very very interesting historical book. So the question is Purim a case of modern anti-Semitism or medieval anti-Semitism? There is a common way of looking at it, that it was modern anti-Semitism. There was nothing that the Jew could do. This is how our sages sometimes present it. There was nothing the Jew could do. Haman was angry, and he wanted to kill all the Jews. He'd got the king to agree, and there was no hope. However, there is, in Kabbalistic traditions, there's another perspective on it, which is that it puts it more in the framework of medieval anti-Semitism. In other words, why was Haman so angry? He was angry because Mordechai wouldn't bow down to him. In other words, he as an idol was being rejected, he or his idol that he was wearing. So there is a tradition, a Kabbalistic tradition, that it's not found in the Talmud, that if the Jews would have said to Haman, listen, we accept your religion, we accept you as our God, or your idol as our God, Mordechai, he doesn't, forget about him, we're with you, they would have been all right. They would have been all right, and the whole thing would have been resolved, and Haman would have been satisfied with that. But the Jews didn't do that. Even though they were so assimilated that they were eating from non-kosher food at the banquet and so on, and they weren't bothered by the vessels of the temple that were on display, they nonetheless, when it came to this threat from Haman, it suddenly aroused their sense of Jewish identity. And at this point, they were ready to be a Jew. And the Midrash says, they said to Mordechai, Itcha anu lechayim ulemavet. We are with you for life or for death. Now that quality of mesirat nefesh, of self-sacrifice, of determination to be a Jew, come what may, that is seen by the sages as a very profound spiritual quality. That is something which reaches from the essence of the individual to the essence of the divine. And so that is what reveals this Hadassah dimension. You see, there's the Esther dimension and then there's the Hadassah dimension. And the revealing of the Hadassah dimension, that was achieved by their step of self-sacrifice. And that ultimately is the way in which the Purim story unfolds, that the Jews reach that deep level of themselves, and as a result of that, Nodedo Shnat HaMelech, the sleep of the king was disturbed. You remember that turning point in the story, it's chapter 6 actually, it's on page 188.
And when he goes and reads his chronicle.
That's right. Valayla Ahu, on that night, Nadada Shnat HaMelech, the king, the sleep of the king was disturbed, and he said, bring the book of Chronicles, and he reads there that Mordechai had saved him in some way, that there were two people plotting against his life, and Mordechai had discovered them and had told Esther and saved the king's life. So the king now says, was Mordechai rewarded for this? And they say no. So the king starts thinking, what reward should I give him? At that moment, Haman walks into his palace, and he's come through the garden. He's come because he wants Mordechai to be hung. And he's, because he's so angry about Mordechai, he wants to preempt the whole massacre that he's planning for the 13th of Adar, because this night is the night in between the two banquets that Esther makes. Esther goes to see the king, and he stretches out his scepter, and he says, I'll give you half my kingdom. She says, I want the king and Haman to come to my banquet this evening. She makes a banquet. Then that night, the king is alone, and he cannot sleep. And the next night, there's going to be another banquet, with the king and Haman. So this is in between the two. And Haman, meanwhile, is so angry that Mordechai, when he went home from the banquet, Mordechai again wouldn't bow to him. He goes home and tells his wife. Actually, this is a very interesting thing. It's on the same page, page 188. Now, this is something that the sages don't say, but I think it's a very, very significant thing. Haman is just, it's at the top of the page. Haman is telling his wife and his friends how wonderful he is, and it's so great, and the queen has invited him to a banquet, and he's been at this banquet, and he's going to another banquet. It's all wonderful. Look at verse 13. V'chol ze einenu shoveli, all this is worth nothing to me. B'cholei tashani roet Mordechai ha-Yehudi, whenever I see Mordechai, the Jew, Yoshev b'shar ha-Melech, sitting at the gate of the king, and he doesn't bow to me. So Zeresh, his wife, says to him, well, you know what you should do? Make a gallows 50 cubits high and hang Mordechai on the gallows. Go to the king and ask for permission to that. Now, what I see is very significant. These words, all this is worth nothing to me. I think that's the key to a lot of depression in life. A person has everything going beautifully, or many things going beautifully, but there's something that really bothers them. And because of that thing, that everything is worthless. That's right. It's all worthless. So that, to me, is the Haman
concept.
The Haman approach.
Yeah.
Yeah, so don't be Haman. You know, like, step out of that. See, you know, all right, so this is a problem, but then on the other hand, there's that. And not to make one thing the fulcrum around which everything turns in this destructive way. That's,
do like men do, put it in a box and put it away.
Yes, yes. On the other hand, it might be that you can say the other way around. You can have one good thing, and you can say, you know what, that good thing is so good, I don't care about all the rest. You know?
Yeah.
You know, maybe that is, I'd suggest that is a good practice. But don't let it work in the negative way. Anyway, so that is, so that night, the sleep of the king was disturbed. Now here we come back to the whole thing of the hiding of the face, the sleep of God. It's the sleep of King Ahasuerus in the story. But in the meta story, it's the sleep of God. The apparent sleep that everything is able to run on in this wild, chaotic way.
But it's not really chaotic and it's not random.
It's not chaotic and it's not random, but it looks like it. There's a verse in the Bible, Shamamit beheichal, Shamamit beyadayim titpas. Vehi beheichal melech. A spider can be caught in the hand, so it's very weak, but it's also in the throne room of the king. That you have a throne room of the king, and somewhere in the rafters there's a spider there as well. You know, so there you have that aspect of kingship where anything can happen. And that's really God and our relationship with God, and anything can happen and does happen. Although, as Millie says, ultimately it's all being guided by God. So here we have, in a more tangible way, the sleep of the king is disturbed, and as a result of that comes the transformation of the poem's story. So, l'chaim.
Thank you.
And it's because of this idea of hiddenness and of going to a realm of, you know, this beyond all these different levels, is the idea of getting drunk on Purim and the disguises on Purim, all the different aspects.
You get drunk, you know. I don't know, just in this little thing here about the history of Purim, it says here that the queen hides her ethnic identity, except that now the royal family is dressed very warm whenever they go out in the cold.
Let's see.
Purim history.
Purim history. Yeah. Oh, yeah, two.
Esther, nice.
Oh, wait, in other words, he means she's modest. I'm not quite sure what it means.
Well, he thought it was sort of silly pun, but it doesn't work.
They're trying to be funny.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
And to appeal.
Appeal.
It's to appeal to like a teenager.
Yes.
The children, not to just go in their costumes, but put on a coat when they go out because it's winter.
Maybe.
Probably.
Thank you, Tony.